From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. We're broadcasting from the studios of KMLB in Monroe, Louisiana. It's Thanksgiving weekend. Are you really full still? I hope you've had a chance to spend some time with family and loved ones. And I especially hope that the arguments that dominated the media and many conversations about politics and religion have taken a back seat, at least for a while, to turkey and stuffing, harmony and common ground at your table. At our table, we talked an awful lot about football. That's a safe subject. And now here's what we've cooked up for this Thanksgiving weekend for State of Belief Radio. Why does it seem that Christmas invades the malls early and earlier every year? I've been hearing Christmas music for 2 weeks. I suppose it's a sign of a difficult economic climate, and I understand that merchants make a large amount of their annual revenue during the holiday shopping season, so they're eager to get started. But it was several weeks ago that the lights were up and the carols were playing in many stores across the country. The dominance of this imagery, which is mostly commercial but still awkwardly connected to Christianity, poses special challenges for families that are not Christian. And the longer the holiday season, the more unavoidable the need to address the issue, especially with children. Earlier this year, I had a very interesting conversation with Dawn Kepler, who is the founding director of Building Jewish Bridges. We talked about how parents of different faiths can teach their children about religion. Dawn shared some great ideas that are worth revisiting as the Santa Clauses start ringing their bells far and wide.
Something else Americans are divided over.
Good evening. Tonight we have new evidence concerning how angry, how badly split a lot of Americans are. The numbers
are... We are so divided. Who divided us? Who divided us? They divided us between Republicans and Democrats. Hello?
Non-stop media coverage of a divided America easily could lead one to a place of little hope, especially when a good deal of recent coverage is focused on divisions drawn along lines of faith. But an exhaustive new survey of religion in American politics and American life, American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us, provides a more nuanced and hopeful look at the subject, and co-author David Campbell will be with us on this week's show. And on today's show also, I have a few words about what we're thankful for this year. Back in May of this year, State of Belief listeners heard a conversation I had with Dawn Kepler. She is the founding director of Building Jewish Bridges. We talked about how parents of different faiths can teach their children about religion. Yeah, there's nothing religious about the sudden and premature appearance of Christmas-themed displays in stores and streets across this country, but it is a really good time to replay that interview and apply some of the insights we learned to this holiday season. Tell us, what is it like for interfaith Jewish Christian families this time of the year? What are the challenges that you see?
Well, the challenge that is always number one for families year-round and then just comes to a point at a holiday time like this is, what will we do about the children? How are we going to raise the kids? What identity do we want them to have? And then how will we make that happen in our home? Because if one person's a Jew and one person is a Christian, neither of them have the role-modeled experience of how you would do that.
My guess is that one of the big concerns would be not to seem to prioritize one faith over the other, of one parent saying, well, my faith's more important than yours. Is that a common concern?
Well, I think that it's a common misconception that most families are trying to do both. because that is actually the hardest thing to do. And what I find with couples is that commonly either neither parent particularly cares about religion, or one parent is more attached to religion and the other parent is more secular. So if you're a really observant Jew, it's unlikely that you're going to be around a devout Christian. So it's the minority that really are trying to do both in a home, and that is the most challenging, because if you both are attached to your religion, you often end up with the child, you're trying to be fair to your partner, and so you're doing sort of the King Solomon, will we cut the child in half? How will we share this child equally? And that, I think, is the most painful.
So what is the most common piece of advice that you give parents during this time of year?
My most common piece of advice year-round is figure out what it is your goal is. What is it you really want? And you have to start out by knowing, who am I? Because I always say to a couple, your child has to know both of you. You are their parents. You can't, even if one faith is subordinate or both faiths are, well, they're cultural, I'm not really religious, your child has to know, where did I come from? So once you've decided, who am I? Who is my partner? What are we going to tell our child they are? And there's a difference between knowledge and being. You know one thing, you be something else. You obviously know about Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, but you are a Christian, I am a Jew. What will your child be? And then working sort of backwards from that, how will you raise your child to be who you want them to be and to know about their parent, their other parents' religious background or cultural background, and have that be a comfortable part of their identity, because they will, in fact, encompass both people in themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Great point. When do you talk to your children about this?
I think you start from the beginning, and you do it in age-appropriate ways. And that the challenge for adults is that we have full capacity for gray thinking. And we look at our children, and they're marvelous and wonderful and insightful and magical and awesome. And we think that they're understanding on our level, and they're not. So it's important to look at what's developmentally appropriate for children. And I think it's always appropriate to go to your clergy and say, I'm thinking about teaching little Julie about this. When would be a good time? So, for example, for Jewish parents, there's always the challenge of, when do you teach about the Holocaust? This is a big, scary concept. Right. I think that the crucifixion of Jesus is a pretty scary concept. So I'm assuming a minister would help you with, how do you explain this to a child in such a way that they don't feel frightened by what they're learning, and they're taking it in a little at a time, and ultimately understanding, I'll say God willing, that's where I'm coming from. As an adult, they would understand the complexities of a concept like crucifixion and resurrection, and they would understand the complexities that are existent in the Passover story, which can be very simplified for a child, but is very complex for an adult.
I tell you what, if anybody needs to talk about it, I hope they talk to you, because you've got such a wonderful and sensitive approach. Dawn Kepler is the founding director of Building Jewish Bridges. You've heard her wisdom. She's worked in interfaith outreach since 1990. She is a great resource. Dawn, thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you very much.
Still ahead on this week's show, David Campbell, co-author of the terrific new book, American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. I think you'll be surprised by some of the findings that David and Robert D. Putnam present in these pages. Stay tuned. We're coming right back. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Welcome back, everybody, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Late in the 2010 election season, a time when the issues that divide us are highlighted and amplified, a time when one of those issues was religion, there came a new book that challenged much of the conventional wisdom about just how divided we are. American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us, was written by Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam and David Campbell of Notre Dame, and it sheds new light on 50 years of religion and politics in the United States. I'm always interested in finding common ground, and there is exciting and optimistic news in the book American Grace. I'm delighted to say that co-author David Campbell joins us right now on State of Belief Radio. David, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. This is wonderful.
You make the argument that in practical terms, religion and politics are inseparable in American culture. Talk a little about that, please.
Well, they're connected, and we certainly see that in our current political environment, where, in general, people who are more religious are more likely to vote on the right side of the spectrum and they're more likely to be Republican. But that's certainly not always been the case historically. In fact, there have been many times in American history where religion has actually been a force for progressive politics or for a for changes in the American political landscape. And even today, when we say in general that more religious people are more likely to lean to the right, there's a notable exception to that, which is that African-American Protestants, black Protestants being the most religious group in America, well, they lean to the left, or at least they're strongly Democratic. That suggests there's no iron law that links religion with one brand of politics.
Okay, so yeah, let me pick up right there. I'm in full agreement with you that religion and politics are inseparable in our culture. Are we seeing something different, though, with religion and its affiliation with partisan politics?
Well, we have in the last few election cycles, so we've seen this hardening of folks that are on the right and religious together. We hadn't actually seen that in the past. There's been some speculation that in the wake, say, of the 2008 presidential election, that connection between high religiosity and voting Republican, at least among those who are not African American, that connection might have begun to weaken a little bit because the Democrats have made efforts to try to reach out to religious voters. We don't actually see much of that in the data yet. That doesn't mean that it won't come, because these things sometimes take time for the shifts to really be observed. But again, the important thing to keep in mind is the only constant when it comes to either American religion or American politics is change. And so, going forward, it's hard to say actually where we're going to end up.
In American Grace, you give us a number of case studies of religious congregations that reinforce your conclusions. It would be helpful if you would take maybe one example and show us what you mean there.
Well, you're right that the book contains what we call vignettes that highlight various congregations of different religious traditions all around the country. Let me give you one example that might be telling for your listeners. We highlight in the book how, in general, you actually don't find a lot of overt politicking coming over the pulpit in America's churches.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a myth, actually, that people come to church and they're told how to vote. We actually find very little evidence for that. But we do find examples of how there's a more subtle influence on people's politics that comes through their place of worship. We call it the echo chamber effect, because after all, people who worship together have chosen this group of people to associate with, and that generally means they have something in common, and that something often relates to their politics. So we highlight different congregations around the country where we see that subtle influence operating. It includes an evangelical church in Minneapolis, but it also includes, interestingly, a Jewish synagogue in the suburbs of Chicago, and an LDS or a Mormon congregation in Utah. And they all provide examples of how this sort of influence works.
David, I know that various people have explained that particular phenomenon different ways, and just stay on subject with our politics and religion theme for a second. What motivates that? Is it theology? Is it social pressure? Is it individual pursuit of spirituality. How much does politics play a role in that?
Well, let me actually speak to the specific question of how, the extent to which politics is a factor in people's religious switching.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of the things you mentioned, of course, are relevant, and different people switch for different reasons, and sometimes it's simply because you find a new church that you like, and,
right.
You know, then you sort of adopt the theology after you find the congregation that feels comfortable to you. But one of the more surprising things also that we found is, while we normally think of people's religion affecting their politics, that's sort of implied whenever you read a newspaper story that describes the Catholic vote or the evangelical vote or, you know, whatever other group you might think of. We find evidence, quite striking evidence actually, that people's politics can actually affect their religion.
Mm-hmm.
And where that's sort of most apparent is in the rise of folks who say they have no religion. We call them the nuns, mm-hmm. not the N-U-N-S kind of nuns. But
is that the 15%? Is that the 15%?
Right, or actually upwards of 17%, although we can... You know,
sure.
15
okay.
is close enough for government work.
Yeah.
And that's a rapid increase from where it had been historically. It's about a doubling, and it all happened over really a short period of time, beginning in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And among young people, it's even much higher than that. It's closer to 25 or 30%. And we have evidence from different sources, so it's not just all based on one piece of analysis that suggests that much of that rise in people who say they have no religion is a reaction to the intermingling of religion and politics in the contemporary American scene. We see that over the long haul, this rise that began in the late 80s, early 90s. We also see it in a shorter time frame where we could actually interview the same people twice.
Hmm.
And we see that people who are politically liberal at time one are just a little less likely to attend church at time two. And it goes the other way, too. People who are politically conservative become a little more religious over time.
I'm talking with David Campbell of Notre Dame University. David is co-author of American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. We've got to take a quick break, but we'll talk some more in just a minute. This is interesting stuff, so please don't go away. This is State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back. This is State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. My guest is David Campbell, who, along with Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam, has written American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. So for denominations that pay a lot of attention to doctrine, say, over against social ministry, does the political orientation or the political loyalty that you speak of actually change their religious beliefs or just move them to another place of worship?
Well, from what we've seen, it's more the latter, that it moves them to a different place of worship. But, you know, we're looking at a fairly short period of time, and therefore I would want to hold open the possibility that people might actually, you know, change what they believe, or at least what they say when they're asked what they believe on the basis of their politics. So I think the verdict is still out on that. We don't quite know.
Yeah. And are these people moving at their own initiative, or are certain churches really going after those people?
We actually don't see a lot of evidence of particular churches going after them. And what's interesting about that is what it means is there's a group of people out there who are currently uncomfortable with organized religion, so much so that when they're asked, well, what religion are you, they say, well, I'm not anything. But when you probe a little more and you ask, well, what do they believe, it turns out that that group, they say they, for the most part, believe in God. They're actually somewhat comfortable with speaking of the supernatural and of a life beyond, and they believe in a heaven. They just are uncomfortable with organized religion. Well, that suggests to us that that's a pool of people, and this is, you know, largely young people, that are, you know, the proverbial fish that are waiting for a fisherman to come and find them, as Jesus said.
Yeah.
So it suggests that there's this pool of people that could be brought into the pews if somebody could just figure out how to reach them.
David, I talk with political advisors on both the Democratic side and the Republican side, and they tell me that in their political consulting now with candidates, especially prior to campaigns, that they spend an awful lot of time on religion, how to talk about religion, how to use religion, what to do about visiting various houses of worship. From what you see in your study, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, that's a good question. Well, I think, first of all, it's an inevitable thing because Americans are so religious. You would expect politicians to go where the people are, and if the people are at church, then that's where they're going to gravitate. Whether it's a bad thing for our politics, I will say that any politician who begins to use religious language or begins to try to exploit, you know, one religious group, especially at the expense of another, does run the risk of pulling us apart, because religion can be such a volatile subject. And it's also true that most Americans tell us they're actually not very comfortable with their own religious leaders telling them how to vote, or at least sending strong political signals. Americans are somewhat averse to that. And I think that's probably something for both those in religion and in politics to keep in mind.
You no doubt know that Interfaith Alliance and a lot of the people who listen to this show are genuinely concerned about religious intolerance in the nation and how the religion clauses in the Constitution can counter that, maybe. In your research and conversations, what did you see that we ought to be most concerned about so that religious intolerance doesn't grow and so that the First Amendment stays strong?
Well, the thing that I would say that I think is important to keep in mind is our book paints a picture of an America that is actually quite religiously tolerant. And that's in spite of the fact that, you know, in recent months we've obviously seen examples of some religious groups, particularly, you know, Muslims, who have not necessarily been received well by the public. But that can also be true for other groups, you know, in particular communities. But in spite of what we read in the papers, when you actually go and talk to Americans and ask how they feel about other religions, we find that for the most part, Americans are actually very comfortable with people who believe other things. And it kind of works out any way you ask them, you get kind of the same story, that Americans are very comfortable with other religions. And we actually credit that partly to the First Amendment, to the idea that America doesn't have a state church, and therefore we have a lot of different religions, and, you know, the state hasn't stepped in to pick a winner there, and sort of allow this, we call it the religious ecosphere. You know, there's a lot of innovation that goes on among American religion. What that all translates to is this remarkably diverse country religiously, in which people actually interact with one another across religious lines. And that's partly because of that religious fluidity we were talking about earlier. People switch. They're comfortable with the idea that you might be raised one thing, but then you decide, well, maybe I'm going to go worship somewhere else. So the more that we see those connections being built between people of different religions, the more positive people are toward other faiths, even if they themselves remain, you know, in their own religion. And so I guess what I would say going forward is the more that we can encourage that kind of interaction so that people of different faiths come to recognize that, you know, the people on the other side, they might believe something different, but they're hardly demons or something, that's just better for everyone.
You know, I agree with you wholeheartedly there, and I don't know that you will agree with me on this. I don't want to overstate it, but I have the sense that some of the religious divisions that we see so blatantly, such as we saw in the last campaign, are not so much the product of conflicts between religions as politicians manipulating religion in such a way as to benefit from their rhetoric about it and sometimes from the divides they cause.
Oh, I would agree with that. You know, it's interesting, and this is actually not just true in religion, it's true in our politics more generally, that the politicians or the candidates who are running for office, they are far more polarized than the voters, than the individual Americans that they're appealing to. Yeah. And when people are given polarized choices, their voting ends up looking somewhat polarized because those are the only options they have on the ballot. So, yes, I would agree that politicians do exploit the potential divisions among America and then exaggerate them in the rhetoric that they use.
David, what did doing this book do to you? What kind of impact did it have? What kind of impact did it have?
Well, I'll tell you one thing that it has done for me is that it has renewed and maybe even increased my own optimism about the healthiness of the American religious environment. Going into this book, I actually thought that the first half of our subtitle, which is How Religion Divides Us, mm-hmm. that was going to be the dominant theme. But the more we looked at the data, the more we realized that actually there's another story to be told here, and that is that religion can unite us. And I think that is an important message to be told, mm-hmm. but it's also something that's been important for me to realize as a social scientist. You know, we have a tendency, particularly those of us who study politics, to always want to focus on conflict. Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes you can actually find consensus, too.
Is there anything else I should ask you about this book that our listeners need to hear?
That is a good question. Well, one thing that I might point out that many people find interesting about our results is we have a whole chapter in which we ask the question of whether religion has been good for America's civic life. Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is actually quite interesting. It turns out that highly religious people, even moderately religious people, are way more involved in their communities. They're way more likely to volunteer. They're way more likely to be involved in all sorts of activities that we would generally consider to be marks of good citizenship or good neighborliness.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes actually some secular readers a little uncomfortable because it seems like we're singing the praises of the highly religious folks, but it really is true. But what's interesting about that is the explanation we provide for that high level of good citizenship or good neighborliness. And it's not simply what people believe. It's not the religious beliefs that seem to be driving that, but the fact that religious people are generally in a community that reinforces the value of doing these things. And we see lots of evidence that it's actually being in a congregation and having friends at church, not just lots of friends, but friends at church that actually drives this sort of activity. And I think that's an important thing to note.
My guest has been David Campbell of Notre Dame University, who, along with Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam, has co-authored American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. The two of you did us a great service. It's a good book, carefully researched, and I'm very appreciative of it. I hope our readers will look it up. The book is available in hardcover from Simon & Schuster. David, thanks so much for joining us on State of Belief.
Oh, thank you. This has been great. Enjoyed it.
Still to come on this week's show, one more look at Thanksgiving. I wonder what you were thankful for. I want to tell you what I was thankful for. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is State of Belief Radio. Welcome back, everybody. This is State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. I want to take one more look at Thanksgiving. I wonder what you're thankful for. I want to tell you some of my thoughts. The truth is, I have ambivalent feelings about the presidential proclamation issued prior to each Thanksgiving Day. Now, admittedly, maybe I'm hard-headed, obstinate, or just a strict separationist when it comes to religion and government, but I frankly don't like the president telling me when to give thanks any more than I want the president telling me when to pray. Of course, the practice of Thanksgiving is not a distinctively religious one. From time to time, people of any sensitivity feel the need to say thank you to somebody. In fact, I am afraid of people who consider themselves so self-sufficient that they never feel a need for anybody else in their life or an urge to say thank you to others who are a part of their lives. So, presidential proclamation or not, Thanksgiving Day can be good for our nation. It's important that we recognize the reality of our interdependence domestically and internationally. Now, pondering such thoughts brought me to a question worthy of consideration and ultimately a satisfactory answer. What makes me thankful? Okay, I have to be honest. Often when I think about Thanksgiving, I feel thankful for three realities. First, food. From pasta to pizza, hummus to hot dogs, bologna to baked bread, falafel to French fries, turkey to tiramisu. And second, I am thankful to and for various professions, artists and athletes, scientists and civil servants, teachers and musicians. And third, as a result of my faith, I'm thankful for different houses of worship, cathedrals and gurdwaras, temples and synagogues, shrines and monasteries, churches and mosques, tabernacles and brush arbors. But one very specific source of thanksgiving is on my mind this year, and that is change. Change. Change for change's sake may not be good, but change for good's sake is always a cause of gratitude. Seldom, though, is change seen as a common source of thanksgiving. Well, the past 10 days have brought me face to face with changes for which I give thanks. First, the United States Air Force Academy invited me to join a small delegation to the Academy to look at the status of religious liberty in that institution, previously so battered by First Amendment violations. 2 days at the Academy, interacting with its highest-ranking officers, were filled with serious conversations, hard questions like, how do I know you're telling me the truth? And enlightening information. I found no defensiveness on the part of the Air Force Academy officials or students. I met a cadre of new officers seriously seeking to continue corrections that make the past religious freedom violations there no longer a cause for criticism. Of course, more challenges remain. All fear of religious harassment must be removed from the Academy. But stringent efforts are moving towards such goals. The program and curriculum we carefully reviewed hold great promise for a future filled with compliance to the First Amendment of the Constitution and respect for all religions and no religion among cadets, faculty, and administrative staff. A lot more work is to be done, to be sure, but change is underway. Change for the better. Change for which I'm thankful. The day I flew back to D.C. from the Air Force Academy, President Obama issued an amended executive order regarding the faith-based office in the White House. You know I have been an opponent of that office since its inception. Because I was on the president's task force to reform that office, I was notified about the release of the executive order the day before it was issued. President Obama retained much of the language of President Bush's executive order that started what we often call a solution looking for a problem. However, the new executive order did draw darker, firmer boundaries between religious institutions and government, recognized the importance of the program respecting not impeding religious liberty, and mandated more transparency regarding the recipients of federal funds and how they are used in a religious context. It was not all I wanted it to be, but the president's executive order was a step in the right direction, a document sensitive to the Constitution and a foundation on which still more work can be done to see that the faith-based initiative is not synonymous with a breach of religious freedom. And for all of that, I am thankful. Finally, the congressional hearing on the faith-based office, convened and chaired by Congressman Gerald Nadler, highlighted additional work to be done on the faith-based initiative and the absolute necessity of President Obama addressing the critical issue of religious service providers practicing employment discrimination funded by federal tax dollars. Republican members of the investigative panel, however, held out no promise of working to resolve this issue under their leadership, rather strengthening the right of discrimination in the name of religion, even if federal money is paying the bill. I'm grateful for the hearing, and I give thanks for the warning that the next Congress will once again present us with major challenges to our first freedom. Things move slowly in Washington, D.C., as you probably know. So the least bit of change sustains hope and gives cause for thanksgiving, even if it is tardy in arriving and not as large and broadly applied as it should be. But I'm thankful. I'm thankful for any change that makes our nation more compliant with the vision of its Constitution and more appreciative for the freedom that allows the great diversity among us to be recognized as a blessing. I hope you have such reasons to be thankful as well. In fact, if you want to tell me about your reasons for Thanksgiving, I'd love to hear them. Write me at stateofbelief.com. One more time, friends. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Well, friends, that's all the time we have for this week's edition of State of Belief Radio. I don't want to talk too much about Thanksgiving, but I do want to tell you, we'll be thankful if you visit us online at stateofbelief.com. Find out more about the show, listen to show archives, and sign up for our podcast. That's stateofbelief.com. And please tell a friend about our show. Encourage them to listen also. We'd like to expand this audience and this conversation. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. There's not been a time in recent history where the cause of religious liberty needed more support. Join us today. Become a member. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. We'll be right back here on State of Belief Radio next week with more stories from the intersection of religion and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. Yes, he was.